Ezekiel chapter 34, verse 23. I will place over them one shepherd, my servant, David, and he will tend them. He will tend them and be their shepherd. I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David will be prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. I will make a covenant of peace with them, and rid the land of wild beasts, so that they may live in the desert and sleep in the forests in safety. I will bless them and the places surrounding my hill. I will send down showers in season. There will be showers of blessing. The trees of the field will yield their fruit, and the ground will yield its crops. The people will be secure in their land. They will know that I am the Lord when I break the bars of their yoke and rescue them from the hands of those who enslaved them. They will no longer be plundered by the nations, nor will wild animals devour them. They will live in safety, and no one will make them afraid. I will provide for them a land renowned for its crops, and they will no longer be victims of famine in the land or bear the scorn of the nations. Then they will know that I, the Lord their God, am with them, and that they, the house of Israel, are my people, declares the Sovereign Lord. You, my sheep, the sheep of my pasture, are people, and I am your God, declares the Sovereign Lord. I don't know how it will be with you, but on Christmas Day this year, as in every other year, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the celebratory bedlam will suddenly cease in our house, and we will all gather around the television set to listen to Her Majesty the Queen deliver her annual Christmas message. In many respects, you know, it's extraordinary that the monarchy in this country should still command such profound affection. Most of the constitutional struggle in Britain during the last 1,000 years, from Magna Carta onwards, has been seeking to limit royal power, to deliver us from the oppression of kings. In the 17th century, we went so far as to eliminate the monarchy altogether for a brief period, didn't we? Severing the head of the royal incumbent, poor Charles, for good measure. And even after the Restoration, the monarchy was still, for much of the night of the 18th century, decidedly unpopular as an institution. Some of you may be familiar with Walter Landor's poetic satire entitled The Georges. George I was always reckoned vile, but viler still was George II. And what mortal ever heard any good of George III? When to hell the fourth descended, God be praised, the Georges ended. Hanover was not a popular house. And in spite of centuries of anti-monarchist sentiment like that, Britain is still the United Kingdom. And many, many will gather, as I say, on Christmas Day to hear our sovereign's message with respect and honour. Indeed, these days, the affection for the monarchy in this country extends beyond our national boundaries, doesn't it? Many Europeans who long ago got rid of their royal line now look with sneaking envy upon us for having managed to keep ours. The ex-colonies around the globe, in spite of their success in achieving political independence, are nevertheless very keen, most of them, to retain their links with the British Crown through the Commonwealth. And even our American cousins, even they, for all the Republican polemic of Jefferson, they still display, don't they, a strange fascination with our royal family. Can't get enough pictures of them and so on. What is it about monarchy that excites this extraordinary ambivalence? On the one hand, almost universal disillusionment with monarchy as an institution of government. All over the world, you see it. There are very, very few kings or queens left, are there? And yet, on the other hand, sentimental attachment to it, of a very warm and deep kind. Well, I have a suggestion to make to you as to an explanation for this widespread inconsistency. I don't know if you'll agree with me about it, but my view is that there is buried deep in the psyche of the human race a great longing for a king. A perfect king. A prince whose impregnable power would guarantee our security, but whose selfless service would also guarantee our welfare. A sovereign who would deliver us from the bickering inefficiencies of democracy, of which we know too many, and yet at the same time deliver us from the unspeakable barbarities of tyranny, of which we see too much. A king who would not only meet the need of our society for a wise and a just government, but who would satisfy the need of our individual hearts for heroic and exemplary leadership. See, we need that, don't we? We need somebody to look up to. A Lord who will not only win our allegiance, but our love. Now, that idealistic dream of a perfect prince, I suggest to you, runs deep in the veins of the whole human race. You find it among the ancient Greeks. That's what Plato was going about on about when he talked about the philosopher king that would have to rule his republic. It runs deep in folklore, too, doesn't it, of almost every nation. It's what Tolkien is exploiting in that hugely popular fantasy novel of his, The Lord of the Rings, the longing for a king. But if you really want to understand the root of it, it's to the Bible you must turn. And particularly to those prophecies of long ago in the Old Testament. For they too looked forward to a king. Like this chapter, Ezekiel 34, that we've just read a piece of. Ezekiel, in common with all the prophets of the Old Testament, shared these strange, ambiguous feelings we have about monarchy. Right from the start, Samuel had warned the country, Israel, that they would be better off without monarchy altogether. If you go crowning a king, he said, you'll live to regret it. Royal power is so easily abused. This king of yours will make servants of your daughters, soldiers of your sons. He'll tax you to the point of penury in order to furnish his palace. At the end of the day, you'll be crying out for relief from this king you have chosen. And that's exactly how it turned out, of course. For every good king that Israel had, she seemed to get three bad ones, just like the Georges. Samuel's prophecy came all too true. The history of her monarchy was one of decadence. And yet, in spite of all this disillusionment with the royal house of Israel, which the prophets felt increasingly as the years went by, the strange thing is they retained an inexplicable optimism about monarchy as an institution. They went on dreaming of what the monarchy ought to be, what the monarchy could be, indeed, what the monarchy one day would be. In short, they dreamed of a perfect prince. Now, they weren't without a model upon which to construct such an idealistic vision. There had been one king of Israel who, though not perfect by any means, had demonstrated many of the qualities which the prophets believed were vital for a real king. His name was David, the founder of the royal dynasty of Judah. But before he'd been elevated to the monarchy, of course, he'd had a different job, hadn't he? He was a shepherd. He tended the flock of his father Jesse. One of the great psalms of Israel, Psalm 78, reminded the people of this in their liturgy regularly. God chose David to be his servant. He took him from the sheep pens. From tending the sheep, he brought him to be the shepherd of the people Jacob, of Israel, his inheritance. So David shepherded them with integrity of heart and skillful hands he led them. So according to the inspired writers of the Old Testament, you see, David's professional background as a herdsman was no mere accident of history. In a real sense, the shepherd is God's model leader, blending as the shepherd does authority with care, strength with tenderness. David, the shepherd king, came closer to the ideal of the perfect prince than any other king of the Old Testament. But regrettably, though God had found those pastoral qualities he sought in David, they were not noticeable in his successors. And if you look in this chapter that we've turned our Bibles to today, Ezekiel 34, you will see that that is what Ezekiel is complaining about in the earlier verses. Son of man, verse 2, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Now this is not a piece of prejudice against poor herdsmen. The shepherds of Israel are the kings, the royal house of Israel. Prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to the shepherds of Israel, who only take care of themselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? These royal heirs may have been shepherds of Israel by official title. That says Ezekiel, they are savage plunderers of the flock by nature. They're exploitative in their attitude, says Ezekiel. They live lives of self-indulgent luxury at the expense of the people. And the national economy founders as a result. Verse 3, you eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock, he says. They're negligent of their proper responsibilities, says Ezekiel. They display no compassion for the weak or the vulnerable in society, as a shepherd should. Instead, they demonstrate ruthless dictatorship. Verse 4, you have not strengthened the weak, or healed the sick, or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally. Look after number one. Survival of the fittest. Do others before they do you. That was the motto of the kings of Israel. And the result? Verse 5. So, they were scattered. Because there was no real shepherd. And when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. My sheep wandered over all the mountains and on every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth. And no one searched or looked for them. As we would say today, the country just went to the dogs. And nobody lifted a finger. As Ezekiel writes these words, as some of you will know, the people of Israel have lost everything. They are in exile. Conquered by a foreign power, their capital city, Jerusalem, in ruins. Their national pride in shreds. Why? Says Ezekiel, it's because of the shepherds. The shepherds of Israel who didn't take care of the flock, but only took care of themselves. What's the answer to it? I suppose these days we might expect Ezekiel would look for a change of political ideology, wouldn't we? You know, something like it's been going on in Eastern Europe. Perhaps he would become a Republican and argue for an electoral presidency rather than monarchy. Perhaps he would become a Democrat and argue for parliamentary debate. Perhaps he would even become a communist and plot the overthrow of the ruling classes. The natural thing to do when you get fed up with an oppressive system these days is to change the system, isn't it? That's certainly what has happened in Western societies as a result of our disillusionment with the corruption and the follies of dynastic monarchy over the last 1,000 years. But not so Ezekiel. It's interesting, this. Ezekiel promises judgment upon these exploitative and negligent shepherds. Certainly, look at verse 10. This is what the sovereign Lord says, I am against the shepherds, and will hold them accountable for my flock. Notice those words. I will remove them from tending the flock, so that the shepherds can no longer feed themselves. I will rescue my flock from their mouths, and it will no longer be food for them. Oh yes, judgment will come upon these corrupt and ignoble heirs of David. But instead of advocating a different system of government, Ezekiel in this passage rather dreams of a better king. That's where verse 23 comes in, where we picked up the chapter earlier. I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he will tend them. He will tend them and be their shepherd. Of course, he's not speaking about the literal historical David. King David himself was dead hundreds of years before, and Ezekiel knew that. No, he's saying that out of David's line, a new David will emerge, even better than the first one. A perfect king. A shepherd king. A And so, you see, the messianic dream was born. Ezekiel wasn't the originator of it. Earlier prophets had all arrived at the same conclusion. There will come a shoot out of the stump of Jesse, David's father, said Isaiah, and he will stand as a banner for the peoples. Bethlehem, though you are small in the clans of Judah, out of you will come a ruler. He will stand and shepherd his flock, said Micah. The days are coming when I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right, said Jeremiah. They all said it. They all saw it. They'd all experienced the same disillusionment with bad kings. And they'd all arrived at the same conclusion about God's intention to raise up a new king out of the disappointment and the enfeeblement of the line of David. A new and perfect and supernatural king would arise. One whose government would be so identified with the mind and the will of God that his reign would amount to theocracy, the kingdom of God on earth. You see how God puts that in verse 11 here? This is what the sovereign Lord says. I myself will search for my sheep and look after them, as a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he's with them. So I will look after my sheep. Verse 24. I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David will be prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. See, the rule of this king will be nothing short of the direct rule of God. So close would God and his servant David be. And notice the great things that would accompany this new regime when it happened. For the weak and lost among the flock, there would be restoration, we read, verse 12. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them, so will I look after my sheep. I will rescue them from all the places where they were scattered. Verse 16, I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak. All those things which these callous exploiters, these false shepherds, had failed to do, God himself would do, he says. There would be salvation and deliverance for the weak and the vulnerable and the lost. But for the corrupt and the cruel among the flock, there would be judgment. See that more somber note in verse 16? But the sleek and the strong I will destroy. I will shepherd the flock with justice. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I will judge between one sheep and another, between rams and goats. Is it not enough for you to feed on the good pasture? Must you also trample the rest of the pasture with your feet? Is it not enough for you to drink the clear water? Must you also muddy the rest with your feet? Must my flock feed on what you have trampled and drink what you have muddied with your feet? I myself will judge between the fat sheep and the lean sheep. Here's a word against those who were exploiting the situation for their own self-indulgent purposes, growing greedy and fat out of the weakness of others. Now, says God, there'll be an end to all that. And for the flock in general, well, one word just sums it up. A word which Ezekiel's compatriots in exile longed most to hear. Shalom. I will make a covenant of peace with them. That's the word that would characterize this new king's reign. Peace. It's a word of immense security for an ancient Hebrew. They will live in safety. No one will make them afraid. That's what peace was all about. Physical security for a start. The hostility of their natural environment would no longer disturb their rest, we're told in verse 25. They'll be able to live in the desert or sleep in the forest in safety, for there'll be no more wild beasts to threaten them. And military security, of course, that would also be included. Military aggressors could no longer threaten their liberty either, verse 27. I will break the bars of their yoke and rescue them from the hands of those who enslaved them. And economic security, of course, that was part of it as well. The ravages of drought and famine would no longer imperil their lives, verse 29. I'll provide them a land renowned for its crops. They'll no longer be victims of famine in the land or bear the scorn of nations. But supremely, peace for an ancient Jew was tied up with spiritual security. No longer would they suffer a sense of being alienated from God under the hand of his wrath and judgment. Rather, they would enjoy a deep sense of intimate fellowship with him and reconciliation with him. Verse 13. Then they will know that I, the Lord their God, am with them, and that they, the house of Israel, are my people, my sheep, the sheep of my pasture. Remember how David had once sung, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." What Ezekiel is saying here is that when the new king comes, that serenity, that security that David experienced would be the lot of all God's people, emancipated from every form of bondage, nourished by prosperous abundance, knowing the blessing beyond their wildest dreams of God, showers of blessing. You, my sheep, the sheep of my pasture, are my people, and I am your God. It's a marvelous dream, isn't it? The dream of a perfect king. And I think it's that dream that lies buried deep down in the psychology of every one of us. And that's why, even though we know monarchy isn't a very good political system, a great king, a good king, a perfect king is what we all would really long for. What are the lessons from a passage like this for us today then? Looked at one way, this is a great passage of warning, isn't it, to everybody who exercises leadership in the world. Remember that phrase again in verse 10? I am against the shepherds and will hold them accountable for my flock. It's a solemn word, isn't it? Accountable. We've just got for ourselves a new Prime Minister. I hope he knows about that word, accountable. And that he knows he's accountable not to the British people, ultimately, but to God. I hope he knows that that God to whom he's accountable is looking not just for efficiency in the way he runs the country, not even just for integrity in the way he handles power. Now that God, according to this passage, is looking today in Britain, just as he looked in Israel 2,500 years ago, for leaders with a shepherd's compassion. You see, that is his chief complaint about these bad shepherds. Verse 4. You have not strengthened the weak, or healed the sick, or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays, or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally. According to God, you see, the way you tell a great government from a poor one is the way it deals with the weak, with the fragile, with the vulnerable in the community. Not with the way it endorses the strong. Ezekiel's chief complaint with these shepherds is not that they made political mistakes or economic misjudgments. His chief complaint is that they didn't care enough. They didn't care enough for people. I do hope Mr. Major understands that as he embarks on his first year of office. But if it's important for him to understand that, it's even more important for me to understand it, isn't it? And every other church leader. For if Israel is a model nation, Israel is also a model of the church. She is the church in the Old Testament. That's why we very often in the New Testament hear the church spoken of as the flock of God. God may be the king of every nation in one way, but he is the king of his church in a very unique way. The church is precious to God, as a flock is precious to a shepherd. And for that reason, those whom God appoints to serve as leaders of the church have a task which is far more noble and far more responsible than any president or prime minister. And one of the early church fathers once said, Suppose I had in a bowl some of the very blood of Christ which he shed on the cross. How carefully I would carry that bowl. So he said, and should not I then treat with great care the people who were purchased by that? Be shepherds of the church of God, which he bought with his own blood. Those are the words of the apostle to the elders of the church at Ephesus. Be shepherds. He bought this flock with his own blood. If the kings of Israel were judged for their negligence and irresponsibility, how much worse punishment will those who prove negligent as leaders of the body of Christ receive? Now, there is a solemn word of warning for you. For all who aspire to leadership in any walk of life, but particularly in the church. But there is also in this chapter, isn't there, a great message of joy for us. Because it's Christmas. You know why we celebrate Christmas, don't you? We celebrate Christmas because the King has come. Because Ezekiel 34 isn't a prophecy any longer. It's fulfilled. It's history. It has come true. What was it Ezekiel said in verse 11? I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. And what was it Jesus said? I have come to seek and to save the lost. His mind was on this very text, I'm sure of it. What was it Ezekiel says in verse 17? I will judge between one sheep and another, between rams and goats. What was it Jesus said? When the Son of Man comes in his glory, the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. His mind was on this very passage, wasn't it? What was it we read in verse 25? I will make a covenant of peace with them. They will live in safety, and no one will make them afraid. And what was it Jesus? Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled. Do not let it be afraid. What does Ezekiel says here? Woe to the shepherds who take care of themselves. I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he will tend them. Jesus said, all that ever came before me are thieves and robbers. They came only to steal and to kill and to destroy. I am the good shepherd who gives his life. Born of the line of David, just as the prophet said he would be. Born in the city of David, just as the prophet said he would be. Glory to God in the highest, the angels sang. And on earth, shalom. Peace. No wonder God invited shepherds to celebrate that first Christmas day. Who could be more appropriate? For he is the shepherd king. The king whom deep down in our hearts we all long for. The perfect prince whose impregnable power can guarantee our security, but whose selfless service can guarantee our welfare. The sovereign who not only meets our need as a society for a just and wise government, but who meets the needs of our hearts as individuals for exemplary and heroic leadership, someone to follow. The Lord, to whom we not only gladly yield our allegiance, but in whom we freely invest our love. Of course, human monarchy is flawed. It inevitably ends in disillusionment. This is a sinful world. But there is one king that won't disappoint us, and there is one kingdom that will last forever. And that's why this Christmas we may be happy. Goodness knows there's not much to be happy about in this world, is there? 1991 promises to be a year of economic recession for all of us. It's very likely that Saddam Hussein will take us to the brink and perhaps over the brink of war in the very earliest months of 1991. Ethiopia is struck by famine again, and so are numerous other places. There's AIDS, there's the greenhouse effect, there's child abuse, crime statistics, homelessness. No, there isn't much to be happy about in this world. What on earth are we saying Happy Christmas for? Now, in spite of every sign, you see, of misery and discouragement and disillusionment, we Christians at Christmas should feel a thrill, an electric thrill of joy in our veins. The King has come. The one we have waited for centuries is here. Despite all the failure of human leaders, the ruthlessness of tyrants, the incompetence of fools, despite all the disappointments of history, the savagery of war, the tragedy of want, despite all the disillusionments of politics, the shattered hopes, the unfulfilled dreams, the lost causes, the broken hearts, the wasted efforts. The King has come. His kingdom is already in our hearts. His kingdom is already here, in our midst, in His church. One day He will come and claim the full inheritance. Fear not, little flock. It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. So when I say Happy Christmas to you on Tuesday morning, be assured of this. It is no trite platitude. I've got something to be happy about. Let's pray together.